an empty time. A fearless one that yields much different results than frustration and escapism. It goes as follows. You have some large goal that you wish to achieve in your life, something you feel that you are destined to create. If you reach that goal, it will bring you far greater satisfaction than the evanescent thrills that come from outside diversions. To get there, you will have to learn a craft, educate yourself, and develop the proper skills. All human activities involve a process of mastery. You must learn the various steps and procedures involved, proceeding to higher and higher levels of proficiency. This requires discipline and tenacity, the ability to withstand repetitive activity, slowness, and the anxiety that comes with such a challenge. Once you start down this path, two things will happen. First, having the larger goal will lift your mind out of the moment and help you endure the hard work and drudgery. Second, as you become better at this task or craft, it becomes increasingly pleasurable. You see your improvement. You see connections and possibilities you hadn't noticed before. Your mind becomes absorbed in mastering it further, and in this absorption, you forget all your problems, fears for the future, or people's nasty games. But unlike the diversion that comes from outside sources, this one comes from within. You are developing a lifelong skill, the kind of mental discipline that will serve as the foundation of your power. To make this work, you must choose a career or a craft that excites you in some deep way. You are creating no dividing line between work and pleasure. Your pleasure comes in mastering the process itself and in the mental immersion it requires. In the hood, most of the jobs that are available offer low money and the kind of menial work that leads to no real skills. Even hustling is tedious and not really a path with a future. In the face of this reality, people can go in one of two directions. They can seek to escape this reality through drugs, alcohol, gang activity, or whatever immediate pleasures can be had. Or they can get out of the cycle by developing an intense work ethic and discipline. The types who go in the latter direction have a deep hunger for power and a sense of urgency. Nipping at their heels at all times is the possibility of a life of crap jobs or dangerous distractions. They teach themselves to be patient and to practice something. They have learned from early on, through their jobs or through hustling, to endure the long, boring stretches of time that are necessary to master a process. They do not whine or seek to escape this reality, but instead see it as a means to freedom. For those of us who do not grow up in such an environment, we do not feel this urgent connection between discipline and power. Our jobs are not so dull. Someday they may lead to something really good, or so we think. We have developed some discipline at school or on the job, and it's enough. But we are, in fact, deluding ourselves. More often than not, our jobs are something that we endure. We live for our time off and dream of the future. We are not engaged in the daily activity of the job with our full mental powers because it is not as exciting as life outside work. We develop less and less tolerance for dull moments and repetitive activity. If we happen to lose our job or want something else, we suddenly have to confront the fact that we do not have the requisite patience to make the proper change. Before it is too late, we must wake up and realize that real power and success can come only through mastering a process, which in turn depends on a foundation of discipline that we are constantly keeping sharp. The fearless types in history inevitably display in their lives a higher tolerance than most of us for repetitive, boring tasks. This allows them to excel in their field and master their craft. Part of this comes from seeing early on in life the tangible results that come from such rigorousness and patience. In this vein, the story of Isaac Newton is particularly illuminating. In early 1665, he was a 23-year-old student at Cambridge University, on the verge of taking his exams to be a scholar in mathematics, when suddenly the plague broke out in London. The deaths were horrific and multiplied by the day. Many Londoners fled to the countryside where they spread the plague far and wide. By that summer, Cambridge was forced to close, and its students dispersed in all directions for their safety. For these students, nothing could have been worse. They were forced to live in scattered villages and experienced intense fear and isolation for the next 20 months as the plague raged throughout England. Their active minds had nothing to seize upon, and many went mad with boredom. For Newton, however, the plague months represented something entirely different. He returned to his mother's home in Woolsthorpe, Lincolnshire. At Cambridge, he had been bothered by a series of mathematical problems that tortured not only him but his professors as well. He decided he would spend the time in Woolsthorpe working over such problems. He had carried with him a large number of books on mathematics that he had accumulated, and he proceeded to study them in intense detail. He went over the same problems day after day, filling notebooks with endless calculations. When the sky was clear, he would wander outside and continue these musings, seated in the apple orchards surrounding the house. He would look up at an apple dangling on a branch, the same size to his eye as the moon above, and he would ponder the relationship between the two, what held the one on the tree and the other within the Earth's orbit, leading him to ideas about gravity. Staring at the sun and its optical effect on everything around him, he began to conduct his own experiments on the movement and properties of light itself. His mind flowed naturally from problems of geometry to how it all related to motion and mechanics. The deeper he went into these studies, the more he would see connections and have sudden insights. He solved problem after problem, his enthusiasm and momentum quickening as he realized the powers he was unleashing in himself. While the others were paralyzed with fear and boredom, he passed the entire 20 months without a thought of the plague or any worries for the future. And in that time, he essentially created modern mathematics, mechanics, and optics. It is generally considered the most prolific, concentrated period of scientific thinking in the history of mankind. Of course, Isaac Newton possessed a rare mind, but at Cambridge, nobody had suspected him of such mental powers. It took this period of forced isolation and repetitive labor to transform him into a genius. When we look at those who stand out in history, we tend to focus on their achievements. From such an angle, it is easy for us to be dazzled and see their success as stemming from genetics and perhaps some social factors. They are gifted. We could never reach their level, or so we think. But we are choosing to ignore that telling period in their lives, when each and every one of them underwent a rather tedious apprenticeship in their field. What kept them going was the power they quickly discovered through mastery of certain steps. Sudden insights came to them that seem like genius to us, but are actually part of any intense learning process. If only we were to study that part of their lives as opposed to the legends they later became, we would understand that we, too, could have some or all of that power by a patient immersion in any field of study. Many people cannot handle the boredom this might entail. They fear starting out on such an arduous process. They prefer their distractions, dreams, and illusions, never aware of the higher pleasures that are there for those who choose to master themselves and a craft. Keys to Fearlessness. The following is a quote from Blaise Pascal. All of man's troubles come from not knowing how to sit still, alone in a room. As children learning language, we all undergo the same process. At first, we experience a level of frustration, We have desires and needs we wish to express, but we lack the words. Slowly we pick up phrases and absorb patterns of speech. We accumulate vocabulary, word by word. Some of this is tedious, but we are impelled by our intense curiosity and hunger for knowledge. At a certain point, we attain a level of fluency in which we can communicate as fast as we think. Soon we don't have to think at all. Words come naturally, and at times when we are inspired, they flow out of us in ways we cannot even explain. Learning a language, our own or a foreign one, involves a process that cannot be avoided. There are no shortcuts. Learning language sets the pattern for all human activities, purely intellectual or physical. To master a musical instrument or a game, we begin at the lowest level of competence. The game seems boring as we have to learn the rules and play on a simple level. As with learning language, we feel frustrated. We see others play well, and we imagine how that could feel, but we are locked in this mode of tedious practice and repetition. At such a point, we either give in to our frustration and give up the process, or we proceed, intuiting the power that lies just around the corner. Slowly, our ability rises and the frustration lowers. We don't need to think so much. We are surprised by our fluency and connections that come to us in a flash. Once we reach a certain level of mastery, we see there are higher levels and challenges. If we are disciplined and patient, we proceed. At each higher level, new pleasures and insights await us, ones not even suspected when we started out. We can take this as far as we want. In any human activity, there is always a higher level to which we can aspire. For thousands of years, this concept of learning was an elemental part of practical wisdom. It was embedded in the concept of mastering a craft. Human survival depended on the construction of instruments, buildings, ships, and more. To build them well, a person had to learn the craft, spending years as an apprentice, advancing step by step. With the advent of the printing press and books that could be distributed widely, this discipline and patience was then applied to education, to formally gaining knowledge. Those who posed as people who possessed learning without the years of accumulating knowledge were thought of as charlatans and quacks, to be despised. Today, however, we have reached a dangerous point in which this elemental wisdom is being forgotten. Much of this is due to the destructive side of technology. We all understand its immense benefits and the power it has brought us. But with the intense speed and ease with which we can get what we want, a new pattern of thinking has evolved. We are by nature creatures of impatience. It has always been hard for us to want something and not have the capacity to get it. The increased speed from technology accentuates this childish aspect of our character. The slow accumulation of knowledge seems unnecessarily boring. Learning should be fun, fast, and easy. On the internet, we can make instant connections, skimming along the surface from one subject to the next. We come to value breadth of knowledge over depth, the power to move here or there, rather than digging deeper to the source of a problem and finding out how things tick. We lose a sense of process. In such an atmosphere, charlatans sprout like weeds. They offer the age-old myth of the quick transformation, the shortcut to power, beauty, and success, in the form of books, CDs, seminars, ancient secrets brought back to life. And they find many suckers on which to prey. This new pattern of thinking and learning is not progress. It creates a phenomenon that we shall call the short circuit. To reach the end of anything, to master a process, requires time, focus, and energy. When people are so distracted, their minds constantly moving from one thing to another, it becomes increasingly difficult to maintain concentration on one thing for a few hours, let alone for months and years. Under this influence, the mind will tend to short-circuit. It will not be able to go all the way to the end of a task. It will want to move on to something else that seems more enticing. It becomes hard to make things well when the focus is broken, which is why we find a gradual increase in products that are shoddy, made with less and less attention to detail. Understand, the real secret, the real formula for power in this world, lies in accepting the ugly reality that learning requires a process, and this in turn demands patience and the ability to endure drudge work. It is not sexy or seductive at first glance, but this truth is based on something real and substantial, an age-old wisdom that will never be overturned. The key is the level of your desire. If you are really after power and mastery, then you will absorb this idea deeply and engrave it in your mind. There are no shortcuts. You will distrust anything that is fast and easy. You will be able to endure the initial months of dull, repetitive labor because you have an overall goal. This will prevent you from short-circuiting, knowing many things but mastering none of them. In the end, what you really will be doing is mastering yourself. Your impatience, your fear of boredom and empty time, your need for constant fun and amusement. The following are five principal strategies for developing the proper relationship to process. Progress through trial and error. Based on his street fighting as a teenager, Jack Johnson had the feeling that he could someday become a great boxer. But he was black and poor, too poor to afford a trainer. And so in 1896, at the age of 18, he began a rather remarkable process. He looked for any conceivable fight he could have in the ring, with any kind of opponent. In the beginning, he suffered some terrible beatings from boxers who used him as sparring material. But since this was his only form of education, he quickly learned to become as evasive as possible, to prolong the fights so he could learn. At the time, fights could go a full 20 rounds, and Johnson's goal was always to drag them out to the maximum. In that time, he would carefully study his opponents. He observed how some types would move in familiar patterns, and how others would telegraph their punches. He could categorize them by the look in their eye and their body language. He learned to provoke some into a rage so he could study their reactions. Others, he lulled to sleep with a calm style, to see the effects of this as well. Johnson's method was quite painful. It meant 15 to 20 bouts a year. He suffered innumerable hard blows. Even though he could knock out most of his opponents, he preferred to be evasive and learn on the job. This meant hearing endless taunts from the mostly white audiences that he was a coward. Slowly, however, it began to pay off. He faced such a variety of foes that he became adept at recognizing their particular style the instant the fight began. He could sense their weaknesses and when exactly he should move in for the kill. He accustomed himself, mentally and physically, to the pace of a long, grueling bout. He gained an intuitive feel for the space of the boxing ring itself and how to maneuver and exhaust his opponents over the course of 20 rounds. Many of them later confessed that he seemed to have the ability to read their minds. He was always a step ahead. Following this path, within a few short years, Johnson transformed himself into the heavyweight champion of the world and the greatest fighter of his era. Too often, our concept of learning is to absorb ideas from books, to do what others tell us to, and perhaps to do some controlled exercises. But this is an incomplete and fearful concept of learning, cut off from practical experience. We are creatures who make things. We don't simply imagine them. To master any process, you must learn through trial and error. You experiment, you take some hard blows, and you see what works and doesn't work in real time. You expose yourself and your work to public scrutiny. Your failures are embedded in your nervous system. You do not want to repeat them. Your successes are tied to immediate experience and teach you more. You come to respect the process in a deep way because you see and feel the progress you can make through practice and steady labor. Taken far enough, you gain a fingertip feel for what needs to be done because your knowledge is tied to something physical and visceral. And having such intuition is the ultimate point of mastery. Master something simple. Often we have a general feeling of insecurity because we have never really mastered anything in life. Unconsciously, we feel weak and never quite up to the task. Before we begin something, we sense we will fail. The best way to overcome this once and for all is to attack this weakness head-on and build for ourselves a pattern of confidence. And this must be done by first tackling something simple and basic, giving us a taste for the power we can have. Demosthenes, one of the greatest political figures in ancient Athens, followed such a path, determined to overcome his intense fear of public speaking. As a child, he was frail and nervous. He talked with a stammer and always seemed out of breath. He was constantly ridiculed. His father had died when he was young, leaving him a nice sum of money, but his guardians quickly stole all of it. He decided to become a lawyer and eventually take the perpetrators to court on his own. But a lawyer needed to be an eloquent speaker, and he was an abysmal failure at that. He decided he would give up law. It seemed too difficult. With what little money he had, he would retire from the world and attempt somehow to master his speech impediment. At least then he could take on some kind of public career. He built an underground study where he could practice alone. He shaved half his head so he would be too embarrassed to go out in public. To overcome his stammer, he walked along the beach with his mouth full of pebbles, forcing himself to speak without stopping, louder and more forcefully than the waves. He wrote speeches that he then recited while running up steep slopes to develop better breathing techniques. He installed a looking glass in his study, allowing him to monitor closely the looks on his face as he declaimed. He would engage in conversations with visitors to his house and gauge how each word or intonation would affect them. Within a year of such dedicated practice, he had completely eliminated his stammer and had transformed himself into a more than adequate orator. He decided to return to law after all. With each new case that he won, his confidence rose to new heights. Understanding the value of practice, he then worked on improving the delivery of his speeches. Slowly he transformed himself into the supreme orator of ancient Athens. This newfound confidence translated into everything he did. He became a leading political figure, renowned for his fearlessness in the face of any foe. When you take the time to master a simple process and overcome a basic insecurity, you develop certain skills that can be applied to anything. You see instantly the reward that comes from patience, practice, and discipline. You have the sense that you can tackle almost any problem in the same way. You create for yourself a pattern of confidence that will continue to rise. Internalize the rules of the game. As a law student at Howard University in the early 1930s, Thurgood Marshall could contemplate many injustices that blacks experienced in the United States, but the one that burned in him most deeply was the vast inequalities in education. He had toured the South on fact-finding missions for the NAACP and had seen firsthand the abysmal quality of schools set apart for blacks. And he had felt this injustice himself. He had wanted to go to the University of Maryland, near his home. It had an excellent law school. But black students were not admitted there, no matter their academic record. They were directed towards black universities such as Howard, which at the time were inferior. Marshall vowed that someday, in some way, he would take this unjust system apart. Upon graduation from Howard in 1933, he faced a crucial decision for his future. He had been offered a scholarship at Harvard University to study for an advanced law degree. This represented an incredible opportunity. He could carve out for himself a nice position within the academic world and promote his ideas in various journals. It was also the middle of the Depression, and jobs for black people were few and far between. A degree from Harvard would ensure him a prosperous future. But something impelled Marshall in the opposite direction. He decided instead to set up a private practice in Baltimore and learned from the ground up how the justice system worked. At first it seemed a foolish decision. He had little work and his debts were mounting. The few cases he had, he lost, and he could not figure out why. The justice system seemed to have its own rules and codes, to which he had no access. Marshall decided to employ a unique strategy to overcome this. First, he made sure that his legal briefs were masterpieces of research and detail, without any errors or erasures. He made a point of always dressing in the most professional manner and acting with the utmost courtesy, without appearing to bow and scrape. In other words, he gave no one the slightest pretext for judging against him. In this way, he diffused suspicion, began to win a few cases, and gained entree to the world of white lawyers. Now he studied that world closely. He saw the importance of certain connections and friendships, power networks he had not known about before. He recognized that certain judges required certain treatment. He learned to talk the language and fit in socially as best he could. He found out that in most cases, it was best to argue on points of narrow procedure rather than on grand concepts. Knowing how to maneuver within these rules and conventions, he began to win more and more cases. In 1935, he took on the University of Maryland on behalf of a black student who had been denied admission to its law school, and won. From then on, he used his knowledge to take on all forms of segregation in the education system, culminating in 1954 with his greatest triumph of all, arguing before the U.S. Supreme Court the case known as Brown v. Board of Education. The court's decision in his favor effectively ended any basis for educational segregation in the United States. What Marshall, who would later become the first African-American appointed to the Supreme Court, had learned by immersing himself in the white-controlled justice system of his time, is that the social process is just as important as the legal or technical one. This was not something taught in law school, and yet learning it was the key to his ability to function within the system and advance the cause for which he was fighting. Understand, when you enter a group as part of a job or a career, there are all kinds of rules that govern behavior, values of good and bad, power networks that must be respected, patterns to be followed for successful action. If you do not patiently observe and learn them well, you will make all kinds of mistakes without knowing why or how. Think of social and political skills as a craft that you must master as well as any other. In the initial phase of your apprenticeship, you must do as Marshall did and mute your colors. Your goal here is not to impress people with your brilliance, but to learn these conventions from the inside. Watch for telling mistakes that others have made in the group and for which they have paid a price. That will reveal particular taboos within the culture. With a deepening knowledge of these rules, you can begin to maneuver them for your purpose. If you find yourself confronting an unjust and corrupt system, it is much more effective to learn its codes from the inside and discover its vulnerabilities. Knowing how it works, you can take it apart for good. Attune yourself to the details. As a young student artist in late 15th century Italy, Michelangelo had to confront a personal limitation. He had grand concepts of things he wanted to paint and sculpt, but not the requisite skill. He looked at the masterpieces of other artists and wanted his own work to have a similar aura and effect, but he was frustrated at the flatness and conventionality of what he created. He tried an experiment. He began to copy his favorite masterworks, down to the smallest brushstroke. And he discovered that the effect he had so admired was embedded in certain details, the way these artists were able to make figures or landscapes come to life by their intense attention to the fine points. And so began a remarkable apprenticeship to his craft that would last the rest of his life and completely alter his way of thinking. In creating his sculptures, he became obsessed with bone structure, but the books and techniques on the subject seemed woefully inadequate. He started dissecting human corpses, one after another. This gave him a profound feel for human anatomy that he could now reproduce in his work. He developed an interest in texture, how each kind of fabric would fold in its own way. He worked on perfecting his reproduction of clothes. He extended these studies of detail to animals and how they moved. When he was commissioned to do his larger pieces, he avoided that old temptation of beginning with some grand concept. Instead, he looked at the material he was to work with, the space, the individual figures that might comprise it, and from there he would conceive the overall shape and effect. In this intense attention to detail, Michelangelo seemed to have discovered the secret for making his figures come to life in a way that exceeded any other artist of his time. Often when you begin a project of any kind, it is from the wrong end. You tend to think first of what you want to accomplish, imagining the glory and money it will bring you if it succeeds. You then proceed to make this concept come to life. But as you go forward, you often lose patience, because the small steps to get there are not nearly as exciting as the ambitious visions in your head. You must try instead the opposite approach, which can lead to very different results. You have a project you wish to bring to life, but you begin by immersing yourself in the details of the subject or field. You look at the materials you have to work with, the tastes of your target audience, and the latest technical advances in the field. You take pleasure in going deeper and deeper into these fine points. Your research is intense. From this knowledge, you shape the project itself, grounding it in reality rather than in airy concepts in your head. Operating this way helps you slow your mind down and develop patience for detailed work, an essential skill for mastering any craft. Rediscover your natural persistence. This is the dilemma we all face. To accomplish anything worthwhile in life generally takes some time, often in blocks of years. But we are creatures who find it very hard to manage such long periods. We are immersed in the day-to-day. Our emotions fluctuate with each encounter. We have immediate desires we are constantly working to satisfy. In that long period of time that we need to reach a goal, we are assailed by 1,000 distractions and temptations that seem more interesting. We lose sight of our objectives and end up following some detour. This is the source of so many of the failures in our lives. To force yourself past any obstacle or temptation, you must be persistent. As children, we all had this quality because we were single-minded. You must simply rediscover and redevelop this character trait. First, you must understand the role that your energy level plays in mastering a process and bringing something to completion. If you take on added goals or new tasks, your focus will be broken up, and you will never attain what you wanted in the first place. You cannot persist on 2 or 3 paths, so avoid that temptation. Second, try breaking things up into smaller blocks of time. You have a large goal, but there are steps along the way, and steps within the steps. These steps represent months instead of years. Reaching these smaller goals gives you a sense of tangible reward and progress. This will make it easier for you to resist any diversions along the way and fearlessly push ahead. Remember, anything will give way to a sustained, persistent attack on your part. Reversal of perspective. We generally experience boredom as something painful and to be avoided at all costs. From childhood on, we develop the habit of immediately looking for some activity to kill the feeling. But this activity, if repeated often enough, becomes boring as well. And so for our entire lives, we must search and search for novel amusements. New friends, new trends to latch on to, new forms of entertainment, new religions or causes to believe in. This search might lead us to change our careers and set us on a path of meandering here and there, in search of something to dull the sensation. But in all of these cases, the root of the problem is not boredom itself, but our relationship to it. Try to look at boredom from the opposite perspective, as a call for you to slow yourself down, to stop searching for endless distractions. This might mean forcing yourself to spend time alone, overcoming that childish inability to sit still. When you work through such self-imposed boredom, you will find your mind clicks into gear. New and unexpected thoughts will come to you to fill the void. To feel inspired, you must first experience a moment of emptiness. Use such moments to assess the day that went by, to measure where you are headed. It is a relief to not feel that constant need for outside entertainment. On a higher level of this re-education, you might choose a book to overcome your boredom. But instead of reading being a passive process of diversion, you actively mentally engage the author in an argument or discussion, making the book come to life in your head. At a further point, you take up a side activity, cultural or physical, that requires a repetitive process to master. You discover a calming effect in the repetitive element itself. In this way, boredom becomes your great ally. It helps you to slow things down, develop patience and self-discipline. Through this process, you will be able to withstand the inevitable empty moments of life and convert them into your own private pleasures. The following is a quote from Friedrich Nietzsche. "Now there are individuals who would rather perish than work without taking pleasure in their work. They are choosy and have no use for ample rewards if the work is not itself the reward of rewards. They do not fear boredom as much as work without pleasure. Indeed, they need a lot of boredom if their work is to succeed. For all inventive spirits, boredom is that disagreeable lull of the soul that precedes a happy voyage and cheerful winds."
Chapter 9. Push beyond your limits. Self-belief. Your sense of who you are will determine your actions and what you end up getting in life. If you see your reach is limited, that you are mostly helpless in the face of so many difficulties, that it's best to keep your ambitions low, then you will receive the little that you expect. Knowing this dynamic, you must train yourself for the opposite. Ask for more, aim high, and believe that you are destined for something great. Your sense of self-worth comes from you alone, never the opinion of others. With the rising confidence in your abilities, you will take risks that will increase your chances of success. People follow those who know where they're going, so cultivate an air of certainty and boldness.
The Hustler's Ambition. The following is a quote from James Baldwin. "Let me point out to you that freedom is not something that anybody can be given. Freedom is something people take, and people are as free as they want to be." Curtis Jackson's mother, Sabrina, had one powerful ambition in her life: to somehow make enough money to move her and her son far away from the hood. She had had Curtis when she was 15, and the only reasonable outlet at that age for making any good money was dealing drugs. It was a particularly dangerous life for a female hustler, and so she built up an intimidating presence to protect herself. She was tougher and more fearless than many of the male dealers. Her only soft spot was her son. She wanted a different fate for him than hustling. To shelter him from the life she led, she had him stay with her parents in Southside, Queens. As often as possible, she would show up with presents for the boy and to keep an eye on him. Someday soon, they would move to a better place. As part of a drug beef, Sabrina was murdered at the age of 23, and from that moment on, it looked like Curtis's fate in this world had been sealed. He was now essentially alone. No parents or real mentor to give him a sense of direction. It seemed almost certain that the following scenario would play itself out. He would drift towards life on the streets. To prove his toughness, he would eventually have to resort to violence and crime. He would find his way into the prison system, and he would probably return for several stints. His life would basically be confined to this neighborhood, and as he got older, he could turn to drugs or alcohol to see him through, or at best a series of menial jobs. All the statistics on parentless children growing up in such an environment pointed towards this limited and bleak future. And yet in his mind, something much different was taking shape. With his mother gone, he spent more and more time alone and began to indulge himself in fantasies that carried him far beyond his neighborhood. He saw himself as a leader of some sort, perhaps in business or in war. He visualized in great detail the places where he would live, the cars he would drive, the outside world he would someday explore. It was a life of freedom and possibility. But these were not mere fantasies. They were real. They were destined to happen. He could see them clearly. Most important, he felt that his mother was looking after him. Her energy and ambition were inside him now. Oddly enough, he would follow in her footsteps with the same plan, to hustle and get out of the game. To avoid her fate, he forged an intense belief that nothing could stop him. Not a gunshot, the schemes of other hustlers, or the police. These streets would not confine him. In May of 2000, Curtis, now known as 50 Cent, somehow survived the 9 bullets that a hired assassin had pumped into his body. The timing of the attack had been particularly poignant. After years of hustling on the streets and in music, his first album had been about to come out. But then in the aftermath of the shooting, Columbia Records canceled the album and dropped him from the label. He would have to start all over. In the months to come, as he lay in bed recovering from his wounds, he began to reconstruct himself mentally, much as he had done after the murder of his mother. He saw in his mind, in even fresher detail than ever, the path he would now have to take. He would conquer the rap world with a mixtape campaign the likes of which no one had ever seen before. It would come from his intense energy, his persistence, the even tougher sound he would create, and the image he would now project of an indestructible gangster. Within a year of the shooting, he was on his way to making this vision a reality. His first songs hit the streets and created a sensation. As he progressed on this path, however, he saw one very large impediment still blocking his path. The assassins were looking to finish the job, and they could show up at any moment. 50 was forced to keep a low profile and stay on the run, but this feeling of being hunted was intolerable. He would not live this way, and so he decided that what he needed was a group of tight-knit disciples who would protect him and overcome his sense of isolation. To make this a reality, he told his closest friends to convene a meeting in his grandparents' house in Southside, Queens. They were to invite his most fervent fans in the neighborhood, the young men whom they knew to be loyal and dependable. And they should all bring guns to help secure the street before 50 showed up. When 50 finally entered the living room of his grandparents' house the day of the meeting, he could feel the energy and excitement. The space was filled with over 20 young men, all ready to do his bidding. He began by painting for them his precise vision of the future. His music now was hot, but it was going to get a lot hotter. Within 2 more years, he was certain to land a major record deal. In his head, he could already hear the songs for his first record, visualize the cover and the overall concept. It was to be the story of his life. This record, he assured them, would be an astronomical success, because he had figured out a kind of formula for how to make and market hit songs. He was not the usual rap star, he explained. He was not in this for the bling or the attention, but for the power. He would take the money from the record sales to establish his own businesses. This was destiny. Everything in his life was meant to happen as it did, including the assassination attempt, including this very meeting that afternoon. He was going to forge a business empire, and he wanted to take all of them with him. Whatever any of them wanted, he would provide, as long as they proved themselves dependable and shared his sense of purpose. They could be rappers on the record label he would establish, or road managers for his tours. Or they could go to college and get a degree. He would pay for it all. "You are like my pack of wolves," he explained, "but none of this will happen if the alpha wolf is killed." What he asked for was their help, in providing security, in keeping him in touch with what was happening on the streets, and in doing some of the legwork for the promotion and distribution of his mixtapes. He needed followers, and he had chosen them. Almost all of them agreed to the proposal, and over the years to come, many of them stayed on to gain important positions within his expanding empire. And if they ever stopped to think about it, it was uncanny how close the future had come to resemble the picture he had painted so many years before. By 2007, after the tremendous success of his first two records, 50 began to sense a problem looming on the horizon. He had created an image for the public, a 50 myth that centered on his tough and menacing presence and his indestructibility. This was projected in his videos and interviews, and the photos of him with his glare and tattoos. Most of it was real, but it was all heightened for dramatic effect. This image had brought him a great deal of attention, but it was turning into an elaborate trap. To prove to his fans that he was still the same 50, he would have to keep upping the ante, engaging in more and more outrageous antics. He could not afford to seem like he was going soft, but it was not real to him anymore. He had moved on to a different life, and to stay rooted in this past image would prove to be the ultimate limit to his freedom. He would be trapped in the past, and the prisoner of the very image he had created. It would all grow stale, and his popularity would wane. In each phase of his life, he had found himself challenged by some seemingly insurmountable obstacle. Surviving on the streets without parents to guide him, keeping away from the violence and time in prison, eluding the assassins on his heels, etc. If at any moment he had doubted himself or accepted the normal limits to his mobility, he would be dead or powerless, which was as good as dead in his mind. What had saved him in each case was the intensity of his ambition and self-belief. Now was not the time to get complacent or have doubts about the future. He would have to transform himself again. He would have his signature tattoos removed. Perhaps he would also change his name again. He would create a new image and myth to fit this period of his life. Part business mogul, part power broker, slowly withdrawing from the public eye and flexing his muscles behind the scenes. This would surprise the public, keep him a step ahead of their expectations, and remove yet another barrier to his freedom. Reinventing himself in this way would be the ultimate reversal of the fate that seemed to await him after the death of his mother. The Fearless Approach. The following is a quote from 50 Cent. "Your opinion of yourself becomes your reality. If you have all these doubts, then no one will believe in you, and everything will go wrong. If you think the opposite will happen. It's that simple." When you were born, you entered this world with no identity or ego. You were simply a bundle of chaotic impulses and desires. But slowly, you acquired a personality that you have more or less built upon over the years. You are outgoing or shy, bold or skittish, a mix of various traits that defines you. You tend to accept this personality as something very real and established, But much of this identity is shaped and constructed by outside forces, the opinions and judgments of hundreds of other people who have crossed your path over the years. This process began with your parents. As a child, you paid extra close attention to what they said about you, modeling your behavior to win their approval and love. You closely monitored their body language to see what they liked and didn't like. Much of this had a tremendous impact on your evolution. If, for example, they commented about your shyness, it could easily strengthen any tendencies you had in that direction. You suddenly became aware of your own awkwardness, and it stuck inside you. If they had said something different, trying to encourage you in your social skills and draw you out, it might have had a much different impact. Either way, shyness is a fluid quality. It fluctuates according to the situation and the people you are around. It should never be felt as a set personality trait. And yet these judgments from parents, friends, and teachers are given inordinate weight and become internalized. Many of these criticisms and opinions are not objective at all. People want to see certain qualities in you. They project onto you their own fears and fantasies. They want you to fit a conventional pattern. It is frustrating and often frightening for people to think they cannot figure someone out. Behavior that is considered abnormal or different, which may very well be coming from somewhere deep within you, is actively discouraged. Envy plays a role as well. If you are too good at something, you might be made to feel strange or undesirable. Even the praise of others is often designed to hem you in to certain ideals they want to see in you. All of this shapes your personality, limits your range of behavior, and becomes like a mask that hardens on your face. Understand, you are in fact a mystery to yourself. You began life as someone completely unique, a mix of qualities that will never be repeated in the history of the universe. In your earliest years, you were a mass of conflicting emotions and desires. Then, something foreign to you is placed over this reality. Who you are is much more chaotic and fluid than this surface character. You are full of untapped potential and possibility. As a child, you had no real power to resist this process, but as an adult, you could easily rebel and rediscover your individuality. You could stop deriving your sense of identity and self-worth from others. You could experiment and push past the limits people have set for you. You could take action that is different from what they expect. But that is to incur a risk. You are being unconventional, perhaps a bit strange in the eyes of those who know you. You could fail in this action and be ridiculed. Conforming to people's expectations is safer and more comfortable, even if doing so makes you feel miserable and confined. In essence, you are afraid of yourself and what you could become. There is another, fearless way of approaching your life. It begins by untying yourself from the opinions of others. This is not as easy as it sounds. You are breaking a lifelong habit of continually referring to other people when measuring your value. You must experiment and feel the sensation of not concerning yourself with what others think or expect of you. You do not advance or retreat with their opinions in mind. You drown out their voices that often translate into doubts inside you. Instead of focusing on the limits you have internalized, you think of the potential you have for new and different behavior. Your personality can be altered and shaped by your conscious decision to do so. We barely understand the role that willpower plays in our actions. When you raise your opinion of yourself and what you are capable of, it has a decided influence on what you do. For instance, you feel more comfortable taking some risk, knowing that you are always able to get back up on your feet if it fails. Taking this risk will then make your energy levels rise. You have to meet the challenge or go under, and you will find untapped reservoirs of creativity within you. People are drawn to those who act boldly, and their attention and faith in you will have the effect of heightening your confidence. Feeling less confined by doubts, you give freer rein to your individuality, which makes everything you do more effective. This movement towards confidence has a self-fulfilling quality that is impossible to deny. Moving towards such self-belief does not mean you cut yourself off from others and their opinions of your actions. You must take constant measure of how people receive your work and use to maximum effect their feedback, as mentioned in Chapter 7. But this process must begin from a position of inner strength. If you are dependent on their judgments for your sense of worth, then your ego will always be weak and fragile. You will have no center or sense of balance. You will wilt under criticisms and soar too high with any praise. Their opinions are merely helping you shape your work, not your self-image. If you make mistakes, if the public judges you negatively, you have an unshakable inner core that can accept such judgments, but you remain convinced of your own worth. In impoverished environments like the hood, people's sense of who they are and what they deserve is continually under attack. People from the outside tend to judge them for where they come from, as violent, dangerous, or untrustworthy, as if the accident of where they were born determines who they are. They tend to internalize many of these judgments and perhaps deep inside feel that they don't deserve much of what is considered good in this world. Those from the hood who want to overcome this pronouncement of the outside world have to fight with double the energy and desperation. They have to convince themselves first that they are worth much more and can rise as far as they want through willpower. The intensity of their ambition becomes the deciding factor. It has to be supremely high. That is why the most ambitious and confident figures in history often emerge from the most impoverished and arduous of circumstances. For those of us who live outside such an environment, ambition has almost become a dirty word. It is associated with such historical types as Richard III or Richard Nixon. It reeks of insecurity and evil deeds to reach the top. People who want power so badly must have psychological problems, or so we think. Much of this social prudery around the idea of power and ambition comes from an unconscious guilt and desire to keep other people down. To those occupying a position of privilege, the ambitiousness of those from below seems like something scary and threatening. If you come from relative prosperity, you are more than likely tainted with some of this prejudice, and you must extirpate it as much as possible. If you believe ambition is ugly and needs to be disguised or repressed, you will have to tiptoe around others, making a show of false humility in two minds every time you contemplate some necessary power move. If you see it as beautiful, as the driving force behind all great human accomplishments, then you will feel no guilt in raising your level of ambition as high as you want and pushing aside those who block your path. One of the most fearless men in history has to be the great 19th century abolitionist Frederick Douglass. He was born into the cruelest system known to man, slavery. It was designed in every detail to destroy a person's spirit. It did so by separating people from their families so they could develop no real emotional attachments in their lives. It used constant threats and fear to break any sense of free will, and it made sure that slaves were kept illiterate and ignorant. They were to form only the lowest opinions of themselves. Douglass himself suffered all of these fates as a child. But somehow from his earliest years, he believed that he was worth much more, that something powerful had been crushed, but that it could spring back to life. As a child, he saw himself escaping the clutches of slavery someday, and he nourished himself on that dream. Then, in 1828, at the age of 10, Douglass was sent by his master to work in the home of a son-in-law in Baltimore, Maryland. Douglass read this as some kind of providence working in his favor. It meant he would escape the hard labor on the plantation and have more time to think. In Baltimore, the mistress of the house was constantly reading the Bible, and one day he asked her if she would teach him to read. She happily obliged, and he quickly learned. The master of the house heard of this and severely upbraided his wife. A slave must never be allowed to read and write. He forbade her to continue with the teaching.